Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 739, February the 3rd, 1986. I have one correction to make that I have put on the radio several times and have not been conscious, obviously, of the error. When I think about it, of course, I realize what the situation is. I got a telephone call from Judge Sirica's son, John Sirica, telling me that his father is very much alive. The problem is that I was confusing Senator Sam Irvin, I-R-V-I-N, of Watergate, that judge, the one that James McCord gave the message to in 1973, March 73, that broke the story open, with Judge John Sirica, who also handled Watergate matters. And it was Judge John Sirica who turned down the application of Advanced Genetic Sciences for their genetic experiments, their live bacteria, in 1984. He's very much alive. I apologize to him and the family. And that was a confusion with Senator Sam Irvin, not to be explained, but those things do happen. I will do more on Advanced Genetic Sciences Part 3 next week. I did get a brochure, thanks to a listener, World Watcher, of the employees. I asked their education level because I had an idea that this small group was a dummy front, the Oakland group, for something very much larger, and I started to share it with you last week. AGS has 31 people working for them with PhDs. Also, they have a Belgian and Canadian offices. They have the affiliates in Belgium and Canada. Their patent was the first commercial use for genetic bacteria engineered into plant breeding that has been approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. They're 32% owned by their Belgian affiliate, Plant Genetic Systems in Belgium. They're funded by shareholders other than AGS, including research grants from the government. They didn't say in the brochure whether it was the Belgian government or the federal government, but with our CIA controls all over the world, it wouldn't really matter much. It said governmental grants. Rome and Haas Company, according to them, of their own literature, is one of the four major shareholders. They didn't list the shareholders, of course, one of the four major. Rome and Haas, this outfit, was started by an American by the name of Mr. Haas and his partner, Mr. Rome, from Germany. They became partners with IG Farben and DuPont before World War II broke out, between the two wars, during the war and after the war. For those of you that have books such as Treason's Peace and All Honorable Men and many others, you can start looking in the index under Roman Haas, and I'll share this material with you next week for those of you who don't have it. Treason's Peace has a pretty good description of their intention to work with Nazi Germany after the war was over, when Nazi Germany would control South America. And, of course, the great geneticist down there after the war was Joseph Mengele, who walked out with the experiments that he did at Auschwitz in his hand, left Auschwitz in January 45 and took them to South America. The scientific board includes a Joseph Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L, Ph.D. and director of the Max Planck Institute in Cologne, Germany. And I'll do more next week on the Max Planck group with Nazi Germany and their forming the institution, the formal scientific institution in the United States while the war was going on. This is a very important group of people continuing genetic research using Lyme genetic bacteria to test in the agricultural rich lands of the world out here in Monterey County. And this is a continuation of just exactly what I smelled it was before I got into the hard details about the company. I was very suspicious of how quickly they moved. Just to update one story very fast for you, because by the time you get this tape or you're listening now, in a day or two, the decision to acquit the defendants in the trial in Rome, Italy, will probably have taken place shortly. The Bulgarian connection completely fell apart. This was the trial of the century. There isn't anything to hold it up, and there never was. The Washington Times, Reverend Moon's newspaper, strangely enough, has quite a long article saying there was insufficient evidence of a Bulgarian connection to find these people guilty. They also mentioned that Sergei Antonov, who has been locked up in Rome in a jail since 1982, when he testified he was in a robot-like manner, leaving no strong impression and giving nothing away. Well, he was obviously poisoned. As a matter of fact, when he was on the stand, he said, "I have to leave, I'm sick." And he phased out. His mind was just literally fried. So he's been locked up. This is going on the fourth year, and I hope they release him soon. There was no evidence to lock him up for 4 years. Another reason for acquitting these people, as I've mentioned before, and it's come out in the recent article, Aja changed his testimony just too many times. There was evidence that Aja was clearly manipulated from the outside, and there was also evidence of his link to the Turkish extremist organization, the Grey Wolf Commando. So the point being that when they find that it isn't the Russians or the KGB who wanted to swing the plot to kill the Pope, the Antichrist, killing the religious holy man, they will not prosecute the right wing where it leads, but drop it all together. If they can't find a leftist, they won't find anybody. So that's the update on that story. Well, now I'm going into the space shuttle, because that's really the story of the week, and we have to either get into it or wrap it up, which either way you see it. But it made its full cycle for me in about 7 days, and that's all I need to know. I knew within 2 days just about exactly what happened. Incidentally, the Pope let out a couple of doves. They refused to fly the symbol of peace. He released those January the 20th. The birds wouldn't cooperate. He put them on his hand to launch them into St. Peter's Square, and they wouldn't go back. I think even the doves can smell hypocrisy and refuse to fly for the Pope, and the shuttle refused to fly for Ronald Reagan. Now, there were delays in getting this shuttle off, as you know. Bad weather one day. It was rainy in Africa. That was sandstorm in Africa, and that's where one of the safety places would be if they had any trouble with the shuttle. It was supposed to take off, and it couldn't because the delays were a sandstorm in India, and the next day a sandstorm in Casablanca in Morocco. And by the third day, there was a cold storm coming on, and it indicated there would be cold weather, and therefore they would have trouble flying the shuttle in the cold weather. And they had a stubborn hatch bolt that just wouldn't work. They went out there and hacked away at the icicles, and the hatch bolt held them up. So for a few days preceding the liftoff, there were news clippings. January 25th, there's a picture of the team getting ready to for the warm-up. They said they'd leave tomorrow at 6:36 a.m. This is on Saturday, ready to take off on Sunday. Then Saturday also, there was a story, the weather could delay the classroom. That had to do with Dakar, Senegal, where they would land, or Casablanca. Then on Sunday, there was another delay, and Los Angeles described how 6,600 teachers and 4,000 students would be watching the launching because of the public interest in this particular teacher. But it went on to say NASA officials were taking no chance of marring a safety record that has been, they've seen 24 shuttle missions fly 52 million miles. And there's a quotation from Jesse Moore, NASA's chief of shuttle operations, "We're not going to launch this thing and take any kind of risk because we have that schedule pressure. We're going to continue to abide by the flight rules that we've always established in the program, and we'll sit on the ground until we all believe it's safe to launch." That was on Sunday. There was pressure to go up, but he wasn't going to do it. By Monday, January 27th, there were articles in the newspaper, space agency officials scrubbed a launch yesterday because of poor weather. They were anxious to succeed today. This is Monday, because a cold front is expected to bring launch-threatening low temperature to the area tomorrow. Low temperature is launch-threatening, and they described the anticipation and the crew getting ready to get in. But also on Monday, they said the crew had trouble getting a handle off the hatch. They were forced to drill out a stripped screw. The hatch had been scheduled to be closed about an hour or 20 minutes before launch, and they were having trouble with that piece of machinery. On Monday, another article that I have describes the stubborn bolt and the delay in the takeoff. Although the weather was perfect on Monday, the problem with the hatch started an hour before that, and it wasn't resolved before noon when the workers used a hacksaw on the bolt containing the late delivery of tools. Then a drill came with a dead battery. Then broken drill pits came, and what was described as a comedy of errors was taking place while strong gusts of wind were coming across the runway. And launch director Gene Thomas said at 12:30 p.m. on Monday that a third weather postponement was coming in many other flights, and that they would have to be very careful because Central Florida was having a hard freeze today. That was Monday. The temperatures will be in the low 20s, and launch director Bob Slick said this could cause a problem with water lines on the launch pad. The workers were unable to remove a frozen bolt that holds a hatch handle that is not needed in the flight. They called for this portable drill and hacksaw and so forth, and they worked on that on Monday, so Tuesday morning they were ready to go. Tuesday, January 28th, the bolt has been fixed. The time for the shuttle is ready for the blastoff. The launching would be attempted at 6:38 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now, I woke up at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to hear on CNN that the launch had been scrapped, that they weren't going to send it up that morning. I really couldn't care less. I went back to sleep, but I'm not the only one. Only CNN carried that news. Three other networks didn't cover the launching. They didn't think it was important enough. I went back to sleep, and when I woke up, I made a telephone call and was talking to Betty Phillips at the Tape Center, and she said, "Did you hear what happened? The shuttle had blown up." Now, in the article about the attempted takeoff at 6:38 a.m. for Tuesday morning, next to it is a box, "Reagan address to be on radio and TV tonight. President Reagan's State of the Union address will be broadcast by major radio and television beginning at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time." So the launch would take place at 6:38 a.m., the president would be speaking in the evening, and this is very important to pushing the launch off that day, because it turned out, in fact, that he was talking about Krista McAuliffe and his teacher in space, and he was using her identical to the way Hitler used the Hitler Youth to get the young people in America wanting to go up to the space, funding what we've already done, $22 billion in space programs. And little do these children know how much is taken away from their education, their higher education, from the enrichment programs in their schools and communities, from the low salaries for their teachers, and the strikes, of course, with the teachers not having salaries, and the problem of the president addressing himself to the future. And I'll go into the president's speech in a few moments. It was to happen a short speech, just 20 minutes, because there isn't much to say about this country that is really going broke and financing these crazy shenanigans at this terrible cost. But it was supposed to take place at 6:38 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. At 7 Pacific Standard, it was told not to go. And the truth was that Rockwell had told them don't fly because of the ice. Now, that is the day that the ship blew up. That same morning, Dan Rather was on CBS. This was Tuesday morning, shortly after the explosion, and he was asking questions of an expert from NASA. Very quickly, they had to fill airtime, and they interviewed this man, and Rather said, with a look at the slow motion of the video, some observers, not NASA, said it seems the explosion may not actually have happened in the solid rocket booster itself. And he points out different parts about the main fuel tank from which the explosive material is located, and is discussing part of the machinery. And he holds up a little model. All of the newscasters had the model of their little spaceship, the shuttle, in their hands. Evidently, they run their evening news with that. And he said, perhaps you can see by the close-up that there are seams in the big tank, in the main fuel tank. There is a seam here, he held up the model, and a seam here. I videotaped the whole day news and then played this back and tape recorded the sound, so I could type it up verbatim for you. Now, the explosion, to some eyes, seems to have occurred on this part, with an explosion on the main fuel tank itself. Isn't it cute how Dan Rather, you know, within hours, he could figure it out, and it wasn't hard for me to figure out as soon as they got into the discussion. He said, in Florida this morning, it was 28 degrees Fahrenheit scale. Did that have anything to do with the ability of those seams on the main fuel tank to stand up? And the person he was asking said, "I'm sorry, we have a communication problem. I didn't hear you." So Dan Rather repeats the question, and the audio was off before. He said, "The question is, would the low temperatures, 28 degrees, in Florida in the morning have affected the seams on the main fuel tank at all?" And the answer from this official was, "That is one of the things we're going to be taking a very, very good close look at here because of the low temperature." It did, in fact, the temperature did drop below 28 degrees. This is a crucial temperature here because that is when the icicles begin to form. And when they are forming on the shuttle gantry, there is a possibility, a strong possibility, that some of the icicles could have formed in this connection where the main shuttle fuel tank. The fuel tank itself, that brown-looking tank you see right there on the launch pad, there is some concern. We saw a lot of icicles at the base of the launch pad about an hour before the shuttle lifted off. So we don't know if they're actually on the engines on the launch pad of the launch pad itself. The main concern, of course, is if there were any icicles on the shuttle or the solid rocket boosters or on the main tank itself. That was CBS right, fairly early in the morning, Dan Rather. Now, the next day, there was an interview, a press conference with officials from NASA. And one of the questions was for Dr. Graham, William Graham, who was the acting head of NASA. Question, "I've been told that Rockwell saw the pictures of the ice at 29 degrees temperature yesterday and was concerned enough about the picture to call for a delay in the launch." The chronology was that Rockwell saw the launch and said, "Delay it." That's why it was delayed at 7 a.m. That's what I heard when I woke up. It was delayed. Then they went out an hour later, and the conditions were the same, and the temperature hadn't dropped. And they flew an hour later with the same conditions. It actually was delayed 2 hours because there was trouble again with the bolt or the door, pieces of the machinery. And it was delayed because of the weather first, then the machinery, and then they went on out at the end of that second hour and flew off to about 1 minute plus in air and blew up. And the air was the same. So Rockwell had said, "Don't go," the first time. And they had sent a clear message, "Don't go." And then the big question, of course, that I'm leading up to is who told them to go ahead? Because on Sunday, the head of the agency was saying he won't bow down to pressure. Who told them to fly, and why was it important to fly if they weren't going to bow to pressure and if the ice was the same as it was when they said don't fly? It's just that simple. So getting back to this press conference, the person said, "I have been told," again, "that Rockwell saw the pictures and asked for a delay of the launch. Did you receive such a call? And if so, why was it not acted upon?" And Dr. Graham said, "I will refer that question to Jesse Moore." Again, he's the head of the space agency there. "I will refer that question to Jesse Moore." And he took the mic and said, "There was a series of technical problems, of technical meetings yesterday morning about the ice on the launch." Now, the ice was a source of concern, and they did have meetings regarding the ice on the launch. The ice team went out in the inspection early in the morning, very early in the morning, and that's just when they were ready to take off, about 15 minutes before. And they came back and reported. And he says they reported, but what they reported is, "Don't go." That's why they didn't go. They said, "Don't go." Then he said, "A technical team did sit down," this is an hour later, "all the NASA people involved, as well as the contract team. And we did feel the conditions at the launch pad were susceptible to launch." Now, he leaves out the Pentagon, and the Pentagon is important, and the Air Force, because they were running this whole thing from Washington, D.C. This is part of the Star Wars space, in using space for warfare operation, with the teacher as the cover, hiding behind the petticoats of this lovely teacher mother, etc. So the team at NASA, he said, NASA and the contract team involved, not again the Pentagon or the Air Force in Washington, D.C., and they decided that conditions were susceptible and basically recommended that we launch, whatever that is, we basically recommended, they did, that we launch. In addition to that, there was a follow-up activity initiated yesterday, that's for Tuesday, prior to the launch, very close to the launch. We sent the ICE team out 20 minutes before the launch and basically checked again about the ICE conditions, and all reports back from the team were good. Then he said, I'll refer this to Dick Smith, part of NASA, who wanted to add to it. And Dick added to that question. He said, it was very thoroughly assessed, the ICE question. Indications were that there was very little risk involved. Very little risk involved when the day before, Mr. Moore was saying, I will take no risk. I will take no pressure. Why would they go up taking their chances with very little risk, except that that evening, Ronald Reagan's going to give a speech about his teacher in space, Christa McAuliffe, and try to ignite the imagination of young people to forget the farms, the closing banks, the domestic operations, the cost of education, of health, of housing, the war in Central America, and the mass takeover of mafia in this country, of the banks and of the streets. The kids should look to the future, and the president will go on to his speech, was going to give his speech that evening, that very same evening, and there was a mystery guest who was supposed to sit next to Nancy Reagan. And the big question about the guest of honor, it'd be very interesting to know if it was supposed to be Christa's husband who would be sitting there while his wife was orbiting in space. So they took it up, according to NASA, with very little risk, which doesn't rule out absolutely no risk regarding the ICE. It was the ICE problem. Now, along with that press conference, there was another question about the ICE that was avoided very nicely, and this came out on video again. This was January 28th, the day of the launch, and they were asked, they said, the matter of inquiry, the intriguing question, was about 20 minutes before liftoff. The video pictures show ICE formation, and was there any concern, they were asked, because you can clearly see it all over. And the answer was several times NASA said that the formation on the ICE on the shuttle might cause damage. And they must have had a reason because they kept bringing up that weather and cold weather would hurt the launch. And NASA said it might cause damage. That's why they delayed the launch. Then they went on to say, the same person, the contractor people were not concerned. Rockwell, who made the plane, the shuttle ship, I call it a plane, it's not a plane, it's a shuttle, space shuttle, they were concerned. And then the man answered, we were aware that Rockwell sent a note to delay the launch. They will not confirm, or NASA now will not confirm that this letter was sent to them, but they're aware that it was. Now, just today in the newspaper, February 3rd, San Francisco Chronicle, a summary of, they're coming to quick conclusions on what happened, because the other parts of the machinery that went many times before, even though it was some trouble, were not the problem. It has to be reduced again to the ICE problem. And today's newspaper said, new turn in ICE shuttle probe. And they explained that there were basic questions about delays in the shuttle system and the speculation on the failure of a seam in the perimeter of the booster. Now, those are the seams that they talked about that would tear if the ICE were on them and let the fuel in, and it would therefore explode, that these seams couldn't hold it, and there were pictures of those seams, and they were directly linked not to the malfunction of other parts, but to flying with the ICE on it, that it would break the seams. And in the article in the San Francisco Chronicle, it lists some of the questions that they were asking NASA, and the very first question is, why were there no provisions for visual monitoring of the launch from all angles with instantaneous display to mission controls? So in the discussion of the icicles on the TV and on the radio, there was the factor that there were icicles on the other side that they couldn't see. The camera only photographed one side, and they're asking, how come you didn't have cameras on all the sides so you could see what was there, see before it takes off? And the truth is that there were icicles hanging all over that place and at the rocket as it went up, the shuttle, and they were down below at the bottom, and the fuel expands when it is frozen, and it goes from 1 degree up to 5,800 degrees in about a second, it's supposed to go, And the rock, pieces of icicle can break off and cause the seams to rupture. So within a few days, it didn't take long for them to say, we'll fly again, the seams broke, and that's what happened. But nobody's going to bring up how the seams broke. There was a story, Los Angeles Times, January 28th, that same morning, frigid air poured into the heart of Deep South, threatening Florida crops and so forth. And icy air is rushing from the Arctic into the Southwest, and they went up in spite of it, even though they admitted all along it could be dangerous. Now, as soon as the shuttle was exploded, January the 30th, that was 2 days later, there were many good articles, particularly in the Los Angeles Times. There's one titled Space Program to Be Affected Until the 1990s, which it won't be, and it lists three possible causes of shuttle explosion. One, icicles formed on the main fuel tank might have dislodged, puncturing the main fuel tank and letting hydrogen escape. Another possibility is a ruptured seam in the huge liquid tank may have leaked hydrogen, causing the flames near the boosters visible in videotapes. They could have been enough heat present around the shuttle to ignite the hydrogen, and it might have ignited the motors. Now, those are discussed here as possibilities that happened, and they were 2 days after it went up, but no mention of the fact, even though there are many articles on the icicles, no mention of the relationship in the bulk of the material that came out. Some articles have mentioned the icicles as a factor. The same article says some federal and private experts said that Congress, in a wave of sympathy for the space program, may approve the construction of a replacement of the Challenger. That project will take years and cost billions and sap much from NASA's budget. They have already spent $2.2 billion on this particular ship, and that's what it would cost to replace it. The Los Angeles Times had another article the same day, but by a different person, Thomas Mao, a science writer for the Los Angeles Times, and he writes, a leading theory is that the main fuel tank ruptured, allowing hydrogen to flow out. And this is along the same lines, the hydrogen could have been ignited by the heat generated. The rupture itself might have been caused by an icicle dislodged during the flight by a collapse of the bulkhead in the main fuel tank that separated the hydrogen and liquid oxygen and so forth. Icicles were formed on the shuttle from condensed water vapor during 10 hours of below-freezing weather that preceded the launch. Officials from NASA and Rockwell International, the shuttle's manufacturer, inspected the shuttle immediately before launching. That was at 6:38 launching that was scrapped at 7 a.m. At the press conference Wednesday, Moore was asked, and this goes to what I just read his answer, asked if Rockwell had asked that the launching be scrubbed because of ice problems. Moore said again that the inspection, NASA, and the contractors were satisfied that there would be no significant hazard. And one NASA source said the worst we expected was that the ice might chip off a tile or two. But that wasn't the worst. They said that they would go up and really take a chance. They were reasonably safe. It might take a tile, but that isn't why they put off these flights when they have problems of weather. It isn't because of one or two tiles. It involves a lot more. Another article in the San Jose Mercury, scientists speculate on why the disaster. And it goes into the various theories of what happened. And rocket and expert Don Myronick of San Jose University speculated Wednesday that a chunk of ice overlooked by a ground crew might have broken off the shuttle and sliced through the umbilical fuel cord carrying hydrogen and oxygen from the main external fuel tank. If there was that piece of ice, it would have shaken loose at the point where the shuttle is reaching the speed of sound, and when vibration is strongest, a large hunk of ice breaking off at that point would have been potent for cutting the cord, mixing the fuel, and creating the explosion. So there was the concern early in the morning. There always is concern when it takes off in this cold weather. They thought the day before they would have to shuttle it because of the weather. Rockwell was asked about it, and so the big question is, who ordered them to go with the ice on? There's pictures of hunks of ice on. No photographs of the other side, but the side you see, it's filled with ice. So somebody very important, and it's limited, these men in the press conference said that NASA and the contractors decided it was fairly safe, but somebody in Washington, and it probably was somebody who was edging Ronald Reagan on to his speech that evening that would praise and raise money for Star Wars defense, for shuttle, for rockets, for offensive, first strike, World War III. That's what it's all really about. I'll take a one-minute break now and come back to some more about the launching, the icicles, and the story of pushing this. And I believe the reason for pushing it was because Ronald Reagan had a speech that night, and he wanted to be talking about his teacher, Krista, and have an upper so that people wouldn't think about what's happening here on Earth.